So today I'm in Bath with Candy Gower. So the first question is, who are our mutual friends or acquaintances?
Our mutual friend is Alison Nelson, and whoever else you know who knows Alison, I guess.
Do you know Alicia Entwistle?
No.
Okay, so they live two doors down.
Oh, right, okay. I think I've heard of her.
You probably would have done. Yeah. So my daughter and Alicia's son and Alison's daughter are kind of this little group. They're very close friends, actually. I've taken them to various different things together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So that's kind of my link with Alison through school. So do you drink tea?
I do drink tea. A lot.
And what's your favourite sort of tea?
So over the years, I've developed my own brew, which is, so I use leaf, something strong like English Breakfast or Assam, and then chuck in a bag of chai.
I had been getting the chai because my daughter only drinks chai.
Oh, I like chai.
And
I think
so
it's warming, comforting, not too boring.
What she does, what I sometimes do with her is that I'll make hers and mine at the same time, and then I'll chuck her Tai Chi bag into my cup. And which is, I was thinking, this tastes very familiar.
Yeah, well, there you go, home from home.
Absolutely. So that's your favourite cup of tea. So, yeah. Do you ever go on these afternoon tea extravaganzas and things like that?
Oh, my goodness. Funnily enough, I took my mum was here over the weekend because it was my son's 21st. So she's 86 and she loves an afternoon tea. So we went to this place in Castle Combe. It's a private afternoon tea shop. You have to book. It's the only afternoon tea place I've ever had to book. But we had this absolutely massive tea. The joke was that my 21-year-old son and I couldn't eat all of our tea, but my 86-year-old mother could.
Had she been keeping a space for it?
Do you know what? I don't think she had been making any particular effort, but by the time the cake came at the end, we were like, no way, no way is that going in. So we took ours home, but my mum slid down.
Mm.
I think as you get older, your capacity to eat a big afternoon tea increases enormously.
I'm hoping so. We've got a voucher for afternoon tea at one of the hotels. And I haven't phoned them up to book it and say, and by the way, what will you do for people who have to be properly celiac, gluten-free?
Oh, blimey. What is that going to leave on the table, Janet? Nothing.
It'll leave a gluten-free scone that will fall apart, probably. Oh, having said that, I have had some really good gluten-free cakes on this project.
Yes.
Including really, really nice polenta and orange cake. At the House of Lords. That was very good. The person I was with was most distraught that there were no gluten-free scones, but there was really nice cake, so he felt that was all right.
Oh, that
in
sounds
the end.
Good. I could eat that.
Yeah. So the question which I'm asking everybody on the project is, how do you respond to the statement, Christianity in the UK is not dying but sleeping?
I think a lot of people naturally try to live with Christian values without necessarily thinking of themselves as Christians, because they're good values. And I think that as the church becomes more and more inclusive of different kinds of people, I'm sure that it will survive. I think that I am not a Christian, and I don't have any religious faith. I'd like to, but I just can't quite get there. But I think that the church has a very good role in society, and I think it would be a very great pity for it to die out.
I think the statement isn't mine. It was from a guy called Tim Stanley, who wrote an article in The Telegraph, I guess 2 years ago now, probably. And I read it and I thought, I don't know what I think about that. Mm. Partly because I'm a minister in some villages. They're quite big villages, two big villages and some kind of outskirts. And almost nothing I can do can get people to come to church on a Sunday morning. But sometimes when I speak to other people, they say, oh, this church must be full.
Yes.
And I'm like, but you don't come. And she's like, no. And I'm like, well, nobody else does either. But the things that we do in the weekdays are kind of flourishing. Yeah, different sort of things that we do.
I think maybe people don't feel it's necessary to go to church to be part of the church. And I think the Church of England kind of only has itself to blame in that it's a very liberal church, isn't it? I mean, you can be an agnostic and be a member of the Church of England. So I think in one respect, that's a very positive thing, to be broad-minded and, you know, inclusive and, you know, come who may. But I think that there's no kind of guilt trip or arm twisting or that's going to really drum up the trade, is it?
I think part of the issue is that we don't even really know who our members are.
Yes.
Because we are responsible for their parish, we have people who might be signed up to be on the electoral roll who would vote at church meetings, at the annual general meeting. And that's effectively the only level of membership there is in most Church of England churches. They come in and go out. You don't have a sign up to this doctrinal statement, which you do in some other churches. So it is very welcoming. But I wonder if people don't value it.
Do people come at the festivals, you know, Christmas? Yeah. Because I like to go to church at Christmas, because although I don't actually, you know, necessarily believe in the kind of, you know, doctrine behind it, I think that coming together of people is very attractive and very heartwarming.
So we would have about a third of our population through the church doors in December.
Right, okay.
So that's a huge fringe. Yeah. That's huge. We might have only 20 or 30 people on a Sunday morning.
Do they tend to be older?
The Sunday morning people do tend to be older, although sometimes some of the family services in Killearn in particular have more younger people. Yeah. We run a series of kind of very family-focused services.
Yes.
One on Friday afternoon in Killearn, and one on Wednesday afternoon in Box, and one on Sunday afternoon in Rudlow, which is part of Box Parish. And there we would be getting maybe 15 adults and 15 children at each one. Those sort of figures, but not on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Although we did have a very busy family service with, I think, 8 children and 20 adults the other day, and with the children had their parents with them, not coming with grandparents.
Yes. Yeah.
But it's strange. People, I think the Church of England are worried that it's all going to collapse into a heap.
Yeah.
And I think the majority of people who aren't part of the Church of England don't think that that's possible.
No, because they think there's like a passive, that people are passive members kind of thing. They don't necessarily turn. I mean, my mum, she has a beautiful church in her village. She goes to all kinds of things there. So she goes to funerals, weddings, baptisms. She goes at Christmas, goes at Easter, considers herself quite a convinced Christian, but does not go every week. So I think if people like her aren't going, it's kind of, it must be jolly difficult to try, you know, get people in there.
I think there are lots of big things. One of it is that Sunday doesn't seem to be a very good day for people going to church anymore.
Because they've got other things on.
Because they've got other things on.
Mm. And they're tired and want family time.
The tired and family time is really interesting. I think that's changed since I became a vicar, sort of 12 years ago. Because I think people are, if they've got families, I think people are not seeing them. I think that's worse, probably, than it was 10 years ago.
Because they live farther away?
No, I think because they, I mean, even mum, dad and the kids, I think, are not necessarily seeing each other.
What are they doing?
In the week, they're at work.
Right, okay.
During the week, so I think there are more and more people who don't get to see each other because either one parent or the other parent is away with work or getting home from work at like 8 o'clock at night.
So wouldn't that mean that they would...
They want to spend time with each other, not at church on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
I have people who've told me that.
Yeah, I can understand that. And maybe they just want to relax and don't want to be on a schedule, and because they kind of want a schedule all week, got to get somewhere, got to be somewhere. And maybe on a Sunday they just think, no, I just want to slouch around and wear my PJs.
And well, one of the people, one of the young families that I went to see, where before they were married, they used to come to church all the time. They've got two small children. They're like, it's the only time we can actually really spend any time together, and we have to do the shopping. So it's all kind of, it's kind of very, it's very different. Yeah. I want to do lots of surveys and find it out, but I've not really got much enough time to do that. So I was going to ask you about the books that you publish. So do you want to sort of describe what they are?
So we publish mostly for the American market. So we concentrate on themes that the American market is interested in. So that's things like the American Civil War, guitars, guns, weapons, cars, muscle cars, that kind of stuff. So they're all big illustrated directories. So non-fiction, fully illustrated, often quite large books. So very much reference books, gift books, coffee table books, that kind of thing.
And how is that market doing? Because they often say that Americans don't have any books in their houses at all.
Well, I definitely don't think that's true. I think it's a tougher market than it was. I think it's much more price sensitive. I think, as everywhere, the kind of the leisure dollar is, there are many more things that you can spend your money on now that weren't available 20, 30 years ago. But I think at Christmas and at Easter and Father's Day, they're probably our biggest, oh, and Thanksgiving actually as well, probably our biggest sales times of year. I think books are still a very kind of traditional gift.
So one of the things that I've been really interested in this podcast is whether there is a little bit of a kickback against consumerism, and whether people are buying less stuff because they don't want the stuff, or whether people are buying less stuff because they don't have the money. And I wondered whether you've seen that at all affecting your market, or whether that's not been something that affects the people who buy the sort of books you produce.
I find that a lot of people of my age, so people maybe in their late 40s, early 50s, quite often say, I do not want anything. I don't want any gifts. I don't want any presents. I don't want to buy anything because I've got everything. Got everything that a person can need. And I think that books are actually one of the few things that people do like buying, and they don't feel that it's kind of, you know, like electronic goods, there's, you know, they're time expired, they're polluting, because you have to get rid of them at some point, and you know that it's, you're only going to have it for a short period of time, and then it will break, and then you have to get another one or not bother. And I think that a lot of people, well, certainly people that I know, really like to have books in their home and find them very comforting and nice, just nice things to have.
I've developed, my children have got one bookworm and one who is not a bookworm.
Yes.
And that's kind of, they're just very different children. They prefer sort of different input, but the bookworm has a huge pile of books, yeah, unread to read.
Yes.
And the other one is slowly creeping through edifying books I've bought her.
Well, I mean, because my husband and I were both avid readers, and I think he has kind of become an avid reader. He used to just read magazines the whole time, but now he's buying books by himself and finding things that he likes. And he is not particularly interested in social media. He's not particularly interested in playing video games. He's not particularly interested in That kind of stuff. So, which I'm delighted about, but that's got it's had nothing to do with me. It's kind of, I feel that he's totally gravitated towards this under his own steam, and I think that short of just, you know, buying books when asked and that kind of thing, there's just nothing you can do. I mean, I think they either go for it or they don't.
I don't know. The younger one is the non-bookworm, so I'm wondering if she might find something she
fancies. Yeah, I think that's exactly the thing. Sooner or later, they find something they like, and then they broaden out their reading from that. That's definitely what's happened to my son, definitely. So he started out reading the young James Bond books when he was about 12, and that's kind of led on to things like quite classic books like Raymond Chandler and Patricia Highsmith and that kind of thing. And now he's kind of branching out from that into kind of more general literature. And, you know, I think that's... But I think, honestly, I would love to say that I think you can make kids read. I don't think you can. I think you can only just put books in their way and see what happens.
Mm. My mum was a passionate teacher of reading, and she used to say that if you can teach a child to read, then they can do anything.
Yes, well, that's true, isn't it?
And... In one of the places where they lived, she had a reputation of being very wise, and someone came to ask her if she knew anything about poaching. And so my mum was thinking about, you know, poaching salmon or eggs and cooking. So she said, I think there might be a book about it in the library. So 2 weeks later, a brace of pheasants arrived on the doorstep. So someone had obviously found a book about poaching in the library.
Brilliant.
There's always been that kind of sort of passion for making sure that people can read and that they have that choice.
Totally. I think that you're absolutely right. I think once you can read and you're comfortable reading, then you can kind of... There are many, many avenues that you can take where you can find interesting things to read.
Yeah. I was going to ask you a question about bereavement and how to help people who are bereaved, because you suffered bereavement in your family not all that long ago. So what are the best things to do to help our friends who are struggling with a bereavement or while they're grieving?
I think I particularly like talking about my husband. I don't like to think he's just, because he hasn't dropped out of our lives, so I don't like to think that he's just kind of dropped out of sight and, you know, has no part of the world anymore. So I think I find it quite heartwarming to talk about him. I think that sometimes it's good to be distracted later on in the grieving process, obviously not straight away. But I think some people... Sometimes your friends are also quite devastated when this happens to you for themselves, because they obviously miss that person as well. And sometimes I think maybe they kind of almost expect you to cheer them up. That doesn't go too well, because you don't really have the resources for that kind of thing. I mean, I found people ringing me up and bursting into tears, and I thought, seriously, don't do that to me.
How was that meant to be helpful?
How, you know, and kind of, oh, you know, I miss Colin so much. Think, oh, well, seriously, you know, in the big scheme of things, I miss him more than you do. I can absolutely promise you.
So, distraction at the right time.
Yeah.
Sensitivity about when to share grief and when not.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I went to the Frankfurt Book Fair. So this was about 9 or 10 months after Colin had died. And one of our work friends didn't know and asked how he was. And I explained what had happened, and he burst into tears. And this was kind of in a work setting, and I was kind of struggling a bit. I just thought, that is so selfish. Seriously, that's so selfish. You know, I think... They almost kind of expected that you'd be pleased that they're so upset, but I wasn't.
I've had a few people where I've helped them, where they all been working with them when there's been a lot of very public grief about the person who died. Mm. And so one person in particular, in the afternoon that he died, it was announced on the radio, and we'd had this very public space, but I think finding private space for her and the family had been quite difficult, because she said everybody wanted a bit of him.
Absolutely. And everybody wants you to kind of, like I say, cheer them up. And you think, well, I'm sorry, I can't do that because I'm not feeling cheery. So that can be a bit, I mean, I think sometimes also when you're a parent, because you're so desperate that your kids don't go completely off the rails because of having such a blow, you forget that you also feel very bad, and you kind of immerse yourself in their grief more than in your own, and then it can turn around and bite you. It's like it's got a life of its own. It's really like some kind of wild beast that's, you really can't control it. You can't think, oh, well, I'll have a nice think about death this afternoon, try and work a bit. That just isn't how it happens at all. It kind of just bites you when you're least expecting it, and upsets you when you're in the middle of feeling really happy about something else. So it's a wild ride.
Yeah. And the other thing which I sometimes say to people is that everyone's grief is very different as well. So there are kind of classical stages of grief, but each person will probably make that journey in a different way. They might do one stage and then go back and then go back forth, and so you don't tend to,
well, because it's such
not linear. You don't have like total, 6 weeks of
exactly
this.
That's exactly right.
You don't have 6 weeks of this and 3 months of that, and then that. Cause...
Well, I was thinking yesterday that is absolutely true. Grief is definitely not linear. I was thinking yesterday that part of me very angry with the whole world because my husband is not in it. Another part of me is extremely grateful that I'm not dead, and that I'm still in the world. So it's just very, very diverse feelings. A lot of the time it's very tiring, and sometimes quite boring, because you feel like you're stuck in a bit of a loop. You think, oh my God, well, I've been through this kind of thought process several times before, and I'm quite bored with that now. I think I'd better try and move on a bit. Mm. Can't always do that.
No. I'm going to distract you now.
Distract away.
By asking you what your favourite thing is that begins with T.
Blimey. Goodness gracious me. The favourite thing that begins with T. Turmeric in curries. That's one of my favourite things.
Wow. That's the first vote that we've had for turmeric after all these broadcasts. So
I had the other day I was in Pret-a-Manger and I had a turmeric tea turmeric latte for the first time, which I thought was rather nice. Might have another of those.
Oh, do you think we could put it in with the chai?
Oh, definitely. I think actually it would be improved by a few other spices in there, because it was ever so slightly soupy. Savoury soupy, but thin, very thin.
I'll have to bear that in
mind. Oh yes, give it a spin.
Okay.
Give it a spin.
Well, thank you ever so much for speaking to me today, Candy.
Not at all, Janet. It's been a pleasure to meet you.